The Low Post is brought to you by Goodyear, helping you discover the road ahead. Goodyear, more driven. And as we move closer to the NBA playoffs, check out Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective for all of your NBA needs. Follow the show wherever you find your podcasts. ESPN Films' latest documentary, 144, executive produced by Shanae Agumake, takes viewers inside the WNBA's unprecedented 2020 season. 4 months after the WNBA postponed its season due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the league set out to play a condensed season entirely in a bubble, where 144 players across 12 teams not only came together to play basketball, but also to dedicate their season to social justice. 144 will premiere May 13th at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. The film will be available on ESPN Plus immediately after its premiere.
And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on Monday morning, where there is just a lot of excitement going around the NBA, all kinds of playoff races, every seed seemingly still in play. And to help us sort through that, plus one of my favorite awards to give out every year, Sixth Man of the Year, it is time, for the first time in too long, frankly, to say the three most anticipated words in the history of niche basketball podcasting. What up, Beck?
What up, Zach? It has been too long. And now that I'm hearing you do that intro for the first time in what's, I think it's been 3 months, maybe. It's occurred to me, if that is the most popular, most anticipated phrase in niche basketball, what would be second?
That's a great question.
Maybe the listeners can help us out. There's got to be
maybe Chris Vernon's nicknames for Kevin O'Connor, yeah. Who I just call Kevin O. Kem Birch hater now, because he staked his position as anti-Kem Birch. I am pro-Kem Birch. What? And this is going to be a Hatfield-McCoy level feud where 50 years from now, Kevin O'Connor and I are still going to be feuding. No one is – our descendants are going to be feuding. We're all going to be long dead, including Kem Birch. No one will know why the O'Connors and the Lowe's are feuding. But it will be because of Kem Birch and Kevin O'Connor's inflammatory comments about Kem Birch.
So I have no Kem in this fight. Why would anybody be anti-Kem Birch? I'm baffled and disturbed.
I will not comment on behalf of Kevin O'Connor.
Wow.
So Howard, here's what happened over the weekend. Are you ready?
I have to be.
The games are unfolding so fast that yesterday, seemingly, the Lakers were like a 70% chance to get the fifth seed, and now things done changed. So here's what happened over the weekend. Phoenix beat Utah. Phoenix is currently number one in the West. Most projection systems, because they have the tiebreaker, most projection systems still have Utah about a 60-40 favorite to overtake the Suns, if they would like to, as the number one seed, given schedule difficulties. The fighting Denver Nuggets went into LA with Kawhi Leonard playing, beat the Clippers, and are now in third in the Western Conference. The projection systems are really like 50-50 on playoff status and basketball reference in terms of who gets what seed between those two guys. I mean, 50-40, 50-50. It's very close. That's like a toss-up. And then I think most interestingly, there is now a three-way tie for fifth, sixth, and seventh in the Western Conference, with the loser of that battle royale shoved into the play-in tournament. The Mavericks are 36-28. They would win a three-way tie, Mr. Beck. Do you know why?
I read this within the last couple hours and have already forgotten it, because it's just that arcane and confusing.
Because in the event of a three-way tie, even if all three teams are in different divisions, as these teams are, the division winner,
yes,
without even considering head-to-head, you don't even look at head-to-head, the Mavericks win a three-way tie, which is why most projection systems have them as the big favorite to get the fifth seed. I don't even know what division the Mavericks play in. The Southwest Mountain region, I don't even care about divisions anymore, but they get to play in. And Howard, won't somebody just think of the Lakers? Won't someone just think of the Lakers? The league has created this play-in tournament as a conspiracy against the Lakers. LeBron doesn't like it. LeBron doesn't want to be part of the play-in tournament. Won't somebody think of the Lakers? And so, well, in all seriousness, just before this podcast began, things got even worse for the Lakers, because Dennis Schroeder is going to miss 10 to 14 days due to health and safety protocols. Obviously, the most important thing is we wish Dennis Schroeder good health and to him and his family and all of that. He's a new father. And so that's the serious stuff. And that's a huge loss for the Lakers, even with LeBron and Anthony Davis back. The Lakers played the Nuggets in about 10 hours. It's unclear if LeBron is going to play in this game. Dave McMenamin made that clear in his recap of last night's loss to the Toronto Raptors and would be Laker, theoretically, Kyle Lowry, trade target Kyle Lowry. And so here we go. It's going to be a fun last couple weeks of the season. And this Friday, Mr. Beck, looms potentially. I mean, is it hyperbole to call it maybe the single most important game of the regular season? Lakers, Blazers in Portland. Currently, they are 1-1 head-to-head. That game will decide the tiebreaker between them. The Blazers, I think the other story of the last week or so has been the Blazers recovering from what appeared to be a free fall, winning four straight games. They got the Nets without Durant, I think, or with only one of the three stars. I can't keep track of which one of them plays when. They went into Boston and won on Sunday. Their starting lineup is I've said on this podcast, people laugh at me, that the Blazers have a roadmap to be pretty good, even though their defense stinks. Their starting lineup is plus 14 per 100 possessions, 116 points per 100 possessions, 102 points allowed. That's a great defensive number. With Nurkic on the floor for the season, they're plus 7 per 100 possessions, 107 points allowed, which is a very good, like, top five level number. They're trending in a lot of different ways the right way. And so here we are. It's absolutely, I mean, everything is in play. Do you like the play-in? I mean, let's start there, because it's the Lakers and that's where everybody wants to start. Do you like the play-in, and how much trouble are the Lakers in?
Well, let's start with the fact that clearly the play-in is just part of the grand conspiracy that the NBA and everybody around it has been hatching for years to try to take down the Lakers. I mean, really, why would the league want the Lakers to be in the playoffs or anything?
I will say this, though. LeBron, to his credit, I first wrote about this idea in March 2018, the specific proposal that is under discussion now. We broke that news. LeBron was asked about it that night and called it whack and not a good idea. So this is not a case of a complete flip-flop or anything like that. He didn't like the idea when it was first proposed. He didn't like that. The whole you play 82 and it comes down to this sort of thing. It does seem, though, that people in the league, I think we're seeing a trend here, however. Once the play-in seems to be disadvantageous to you, all of a sudden you get a little riled up about it.
Yes. No, it's fine that he was on principle against it 3 years ago. That's fine. He's not complaining about it last night and talking about people should be fired on principle. It's because all of a sudden they're in danger. Let's be clear about that. I love the play-in, frankly. And I'm not one who, during the fiercest, most intense and hand-wringing parts of the tanking era, I'm not one who was like, oh my God, it's destroying the league. Like, I always thought the tanking discussions at the height of it were a little overwrought. Not that it's not a problem, not that it's not corrosive, a little overwrought.
Yeah, I think Al Horford is listening to this now from a recliner watching The Price is Right somewhere, maybe in Oklahoma City. I don't know.
I'm sure it's a really nice recliner, though. So, as an anti-tanking measure, I don't actually put it this way. Forget anti-tanking. As a inducement to compete late in the season measure, it's fantastic. The fact that there are teams going all out to try to avoid the play-in so that it actually matters now. I mean, it always mattered to be sixth instead of seventh, eighth, because you would rather not face the top teams, right? But there's extra incentive now to go all out. I mean, Mark Cuban's complaint a couple weeks ago was in part, now we got to play guys and we can't rest them. Yes, that's good. More competition down the stretch. Now, I want guys to be healthy too. And there's this delicate balance on these things, of course. But I would rather have all these different trigger points. If you're fifth, you're trying to get to fourth for home court. If you're seventh, eighth, you're trying to get to sixth to avoid the play-in. If you're 12th or 11th and you still have a chance to be in the play-in, you're shooting for that. There are more teams trying late in the season than we have ever seen. Statistically, that's true. Evan Wash from the NBA told me that for a story I did and for a podcast I did. So it's statistically provable, demonstrable. More teams are competing this late in the season than ever. How can that possibly be a bad thing? Also, as much as, like everybody else, I want to see any team with LeBron James have a long playoff run because watching LeBron is fun. And however many years he still has in his prime as an elite player, I want to see maximized. I don't want to see, like, it's perverse to want to see the Lakers knocked out early. I understand people hate the Lakers. They hate LeBron. Everybody else who's just a basketball fan should want to see him in as long as possible. But that there are higher stakes now is interesting, Zach. I'm one who, as you know, has railed for years about the NBA having switched from best of five to best of seven in the first round. I like the suspense and the danger of best of five. This is adding another element of suspense and of danger for teams that are falling in that range. The Lakers shouldn't be there. Injuries put them there. This weird season has put them there. And it's unfortunate, but as I said on Twitter last night, and you know, perverse as this may be, I kind of like the idea of the Lakers having to fight from play-in all the way back to the finals. Like, that would be a fascinating story.
Well, and injuries have hit them to an unusual degree. I mean, injuries, yes, and the protocols have hit everybody this season, but to lose two of the top six players in the NBA for a lot of time, and at the same time, the Lakers fans are right to say, yes, every team has had injury issues, right? The Nuggets are battling through not just Jamal Murray, but Will Barton and Monte Morris are out. The Clippers guys have missed time. Ibaka is somewhere, I don't know where. The Mavericks got slammed by the virus. Nurkic and McCollum were hurt, et cetera. But I think the Lakers did legitimately have it worse than other teams. But every team has gotten hit. And also, you know, you look in the West particularly, the teams at the top are the ones that have been the healthiest.
Yes.
And essentially untouched by the virus. And also, you know, credit to the Nuggets, because making the conference finals in the bubble appears to have taken a toll on all four teams. You know, Miami and Boston are sixth and seventh in the East. They are a combined 8 games over .500. The Lakers are where they are. And the Nuggets, again, credit to them. They are playing fantastic basketball. They're 43-21. They're 9-1 since Jamal Murray got hurt. Michael Porter Jr. is averaging 26 a game on 57% shooting in that stretch. He's ascending toward something maybe even greater than stardom. And the Nuggets they've found lightning in a bottle lately with this bench unit, with Jermichael Green and Paul Millsap at the four and the five. And with Porter, do you want to hear an incredible stat?
I want to hear an incredible stat. Yes.
If I can find it, with Porter, Green and Millsap on the floor. So basically Michael Porter and their bench, those three, the Nuggets are plus 53 in 76 minutes for the season. They're killing teams. And to your point, you know, it's a little under the radar because it's not a team that tons of people care about, but I think the Wizards are perhaps growing into one of the coolest stories of the season, because they got more than derailed by the virus. I mean, they got shut down, they got slammed, and here they are, 8-2 in their last 10, and zoom out, they've been playing well for a while now. They have a firm grip on 10th, some chance to move up, and look, Russ is playing well. He's been a great clutch shooter. Beal is back after a little hiatus, playing well. They're getting great production from this three-headed center monster. And I don't think anyone's going to be super excited to face them. That's a great story because that team had expectations coming into the season. I thought they were legitimate expectations, like a shoe-in to make the play-in. It looked like it was going to be a lost year. You worried for everybody there, for jobs and stuff. And here they are. It takes a certain level of perseverance to dig out of that hole the way they have. I know they're only 29-35. It doesn't sound great. I admire the hell out of how they've recovered in the last 30 games.
So statistically, I think maybe last I looked, like, the Mavericks might have had more games lost to the protocols than any other team. Like, the Wizards were not number one on that list. Maybe they were number two. But just in terms of the impact, Zach, go back to January. Remember, the Wizards couldn't play or practice for 2 weeks. Like, I don't think any other team was just wiped off the calendar for two straight weeks. They didn't even have enough bodies to practice. They couldn't do anything. Like, that's really, really tough to overcome. And of course, early in the season, you know, Russ was going through stuff physically and everything. So it just took a while. So yeah, 6 games under .500. And the people who are critical of the play-in are going to look at that and say, like, well, why do I want to see a team that's 6 games under .500 vying for a playoff spot anyway? Well, I would say this. One, in the Eastern Conference, it hasn't been unusual for a losing team to be in the playoffs anyway, sometimes even as high as the seventh seed. And I don't care if you're 2 games under or 5 games under. Like, either way, like, you didn't have a great season. But teams get their stuff together at different points. And especially in a year like this one, that teams have had to overcome so much because of COVID or just contact tracing protocols, knocking guys out, to say nothing of all the injuries. there are teams that are actually playing better toward the end. I actually think that a team with a worse record but playing better might be the better team to have in at that point. And the Wizards, we knew they had the talent. They never should have been as bad as they were, but a lot of it had to do with being wiped out for two straight weeks.
And so, it's been good for the league, just because the sort of quintessential team that we expected, well, this is the team the play-in was made for. This is the team that's going to hang around all season and try to chase it, is the Bulls. You know, especially when they made that trade for Vucevic, which was a trade I didn't love as much as most people did, but I thought would help their team. And LaVine being out has completely torpedoed their season. They're now three games out. And so that race was, and Toronto just sort of exists, and they play a different starting five every game, and you never know what you're going to get. But with the Wizards, they've sort of given that play-in some juice that Chicago hasn't been able to really provide in the way that people expect. I get the feeling of we play for 6 months to win that seed, and then we got to play a game, and we could be gone. I get it. But to your point, and what I was worried about was a situation like last season where the Mavericks, who were the seventh seed, had a gigantic lead on eighth, right? The Mavericks were much closer to being a third seed than an eighth seed. And it would have felt unfair on some level to put a team of that quality in jeopardy of losing, you know, someone, Jalen Brunson sprains his ankle, suddenly they're in trouble. That doesn't exist this year. Like, seventh in the East is 34-31, and 10th is 29-35. Qualitatively, the Celtics are better than the Wizards, but not lately. Not lately. In the West, 7th is 36-28. 10th is 31-32. It's a difference, but it's not such a big difference that when you wash out all the injuries and all the scheduling quirks and all the virus stuff, you're like, is Portland at 7 dramatically better than San Antonio at 10? Does it feel unfair that the Blazers have earned, or whoever has earned, so much leeway? I will say, I wish there were a way to, in that Dallas is six games ahead scenario, I wish there were some sort of standings trigger that would give a team like that even more of an advantage, but I'm just not sure how to do it for two reasons. Number one, the less random you make it, the more advantage you give. Like, say they have to lose three times or something if they hit a certain standings trigger. The whole point of it sort of goes away, and you're adding more games, which nobody wants to do. And the second part is, if the gap isn't between 7 and 8, it could be between 8 and 9 or 9 and 10. And so, like, it just becomes a little too complicated. I frankly think the league has done a good job building a pretty strong advantage for the 7 and 8 seeds.
Yes. And that's the thing. If your complaint is about fairness, you know, my glib initial answer is, well, then be the sixth seed. Just win more. Be this, like, I'm not going to sympathize. And if your answer is still, all right, yeah, but this was a year when like six teams in the West won 50 games or something, and we were seventh with 49 or so. Okay. If you're that good, you should be able to win a game to keep seventh. Or if you lost that game, you should be able to beat the ninth or 10th team, whichever one comes out of that
at home.
That part.
At home. Not, I mean, maybe that doesn't matter as much this year, but it still matters.
Right. Now, to the flip side of it, and the reason that I like it, and it contradicts the argument I just made a little, the reason I like the play-in in some part is because of the volatility and the danger there for any team in it at all, because one bad ankle turn, one bad call, foul trouble, something weird happens, whatever. It doesn't take much even for a really good team to suddenly lose two games and be out. That would kind of suck. However, as I contradict
myself, that's going
myself,
to happen at some point in the history. If they keep the play-in, which it will be interesting to see if LeBron's objection and some of the other objections actually sort of influences the dialogue at the Board of Governors level. But I think they would like to keep the play-in, particularly if they can prove to the owners that it makes money.
Yes. And then that's the other thing here. So I think as a competitive matter, the league really loves where this is right now. It's gotten teams to be competitive late in the season, and more teams are involved, more fan bases are still engaged. All of that is good. The secondary test after competition level is, well, does it generate interest when it's actually being played? What do the ratings look like? What do the games look like? How does it all play out? We've never done this before. But if that all goes well, Zach, I think it's a no-brainer that they're going to keep this, even if LeBron and some others have piped up with complaints. I will say one other thing, just to make this last point about fairness and all this. what we're talking about here is a competition to be the seventh and eighth seeds. And the seventh and eighth seeds, as I've written recently, are essentially cannon fodder. With all due respect, that's what they are. Those seventh and eighth seeds almost never win in this league. Upsets in the first round from that, the 1-8, the 7, the 2-7 are extremely rare. I wrote this, so let me reference real quick. Since 2003, when they went to best of seven in the first round, which I still object to, only one seventh seed has pulled an upset. That was the Spurs over the Mavs in 2010. There have been three upsets by an eighth seed. Warriors over Mavs in 07. That's the We Believe Warriors. Grizzlies over Spurs in 11. Sixers over Bulls in 2012 was the last one. And of course, that's when Derrick Rose went down with the ACL. So that's extreme circumstances. It just doesn't happen that often. And it hasn't happened in 9 years. And, you know, we're arguing about fairness for who gets to be the seventh or eighth seed, who are almost certainly going to lose in a best of seven series, because that part of the playoffs still has no suspense.
I will die on this hill, though. I think if we're doing the play-in, the number one seed should get to pick its first round opponent between the two teams who emerge from the play-in. Let's just make up a scenario like this. Let's say the Grizzlies get seventh this year and the Warriors get eighth. And let's reimagine a scenario where the Warriors get eighth and Klay Thompson has played the last five games of the regular season. The number one seed, the team that has earned the number one seed, should have the right to be like, oh, no. We don't want to see the Warriors. We want to see the Grizzlies. Even this season, very sneakily, the New Orleans Pelicans have three games left against the Warriors, including tonight in our Marvel game. The Pelicans with Zion, like, that's not, I'm not psyched about that. If they somehow come out and get the eighth seed, I'm not really psyched about that. I will say, if the Lakers are in the play-in, I would pay a non-trivial sum of money to watch that game with Adam Silver and his top lieutenants and or some people at the league's broadcast partners, because there will be sages lit. There will be candles lit. There will be whatever superstition you have, they will be in play during those 2.5 hours.
You have just fueled another 10 years of everybody's NBA Laker conspiracy theories that they do everything possible to make sure that LeBron gets in.
Look, the playoffs without LeBron would be a bummer. The play-in would be incredible tension and ratings. Without LeBron would be a bummer. There's just not just LeBron. Yeah. They're the defending champions. You want the defending champions in the playoffs as a fan.
I just love the fact that because you're, and I agree, like if you're the number one seed, yeah, let's have that earn something. You earn the right to pick your first round opponent. Now, is it picking your first round opponent out of just seventh and eighth or
just
anybody?
Just the seventh and eighth. No, everyone okay, else is out of just the seventh and eighth. It's a minor thing that may not ever matter, but we do this for 10 years. There's going to be a year or some team that's had a brutal injury year or whatever sneaks into the play-in and they're healthy and the number one seed is like, oh, that sucks. Talk about we played the whole season. We deserve a reward for that. Well, we played the whole season. We're number one. We deserve every possible reward that you can give us.
I just like the fact that after years and years of this cliche of who's the team nobody wants to face in the first round, you could actually now avoid the team that no one wants to face in the first round.
I said this last week too. The teams don't like that idea because they do not want to be put in a position where they have picked their opponent and then they lose. They don't want to risk the embarrassment of it. And to that, I say, you're a wimp and the basketball gods should punish your wimpiness.
It's great because by virtue of taking advantage of this new quirk, you have automatically given your first round opponent bulletin board material. Oh, they want us, huh? Oh, really? Well, you got us.
Quirk board material.
Does anybody use bulletin boards anymore?
No. Look, that game, the Lakers have Denver and the Clippers in their next two games. Okay. Brutal. And then they finish with New York at home, Houston, Indiana, New Orleans. Now, New Orleans could be in New Orleans could either be out and rest everybody or desperate and play everybody and play super hard. But these next two games, Denver, Clippers, you know, if they lose both those games, they're going to probably be in seventh by the time they face Portland on Friday in what, again, looms as maybe the single most important regular season game of the season against the Blazers team that seems to have found its footing. And, you know, we'll see how the rest of the schedule unfolds. We'll see how Clippers Nuggets unfolds, but just hats off to the Nuggets for how they continue to fight.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish. Yes! Catch the clutch hits, strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems with nothing on your roof. So who's there up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, watch out for them, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish, but you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Yes, stream your team. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
The Low Post fans, listen up. Have you heard you can listen to episodes of this very show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership? That's right. All your favorite The Low Post episodes can be heard on Amazon Music ad-free. But that's not all. You can listen to other top podcasts like First Take and Pardon the Interruption ad-free as well. They also have favorite shows like The Daily, Part of My Take, and Up First, all without ads. You know what this means? Uninterrupted listening, so no more cliffhangers. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts, so we know they definitely have something for you. And it's already included in your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app for free, or go to Amazon.com/low. That's Amazon.com/low to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Just can't say enough about Phoenix. It's an incredible story. I thought they would be good. I did not expect anything like this. And they've just done a phenomenal job. And they swept the Jazz. And I don't care that the Jazz had to play without Mitchell and Conley in Phoenix the other night. They blew the crap out of them. That was a good win.
This is like such a fascinating season. We're going to probably, years from now, we'll still probably be talking about like the weirdness of the Nets being thrown together and then never having those three guys on the court together in regular season. The, you know, LeBron and AD's injuries, all the COVID absences. Like there's all these weird things. But on the plus side, the Suns and the Knicks, like they're the East and West analogs of each other. Like nobody could have seen any of this coming from either of them. And it's phenomenal. And every time we think, oh, that's a nice little story. Oh, the Knicks are going to be good this year. Oh, that's nice. No. We're 2 weeks to go in the season and they're the fourth seed in the East. It wasn't just, we're going to hang out for a while and be respectable again. It's like, no, they're legitimately good. And the Suns, it was, oh, they're going to have a breakthrough season. Oh, they got Chris Paul. They're going to be a playoff team. They'll be, you know, lower part of the bracket. Like, oh, they're hovering near the top. That's nice. And it's like, no, like with these two teams, it just won't go away. And it just like stubbornly decided, you know what? We're not doing that thing where you make gradual progress and you make the playoffs and you lose. And then you come back the next year and maybe you can make top seed. Like, no, they're both just taking these ridiculous huge strides that nobody, not even themselves, could have seen coming. And as I keep saying, like, this is the beauty of sport. It's the stuff we can't see coming. That's the fun part. Like they have pleasantly surprised us. And for all that's gone weird or wrong this season, those are really cool stories. And the Wizards too, as you point out, from everything that they went through and the fact that they're still fighting at the end.
The Knicks are now two games up on the fifth spot. So they have a pretty firm grip on four, but their schedule down the stretch is hellacious. They have a huge potentially huge game against Boston in the very last game of the season. But I mean, I was watching their game against the Rockets last night. Don't ask me why I was watching the Rockets. And Randall just continues to go on these binges of shot making where you just look at the shots he's taking and think, I can't believe he's doing this. I mean, step backs along the baseline, pull up threes contested, isolations, jab step, fadeaway, putting, you know, just roasting smaller guys when they switch. And you just look at the shot making. It's incredible. He has a real all NBA case. I'm not sure he's going to make my real or fake ballot, whatever it ends up being, but he has a real all NBA case and they've done a great job. And that's a perfect transition into our other subject for this podcast, which is Sixth Man of the Year. And I wanted to highlight some more under the radar Sixth Man of the Year candidates, because I think Jordan Clarkson and Joe Ingles are going to go 1-2 when all the votes are counted. I think Clarkson has faded enough that I think Joe Ingles' incredible shooting numbers and playmaking have, I probably would vote for him if the season ended today. But Clarkson's been mostly sensational for the Jazz. And I do think, given Utah's record, when all the 100 whatever ballots are counted, they will finish 1-2. So I wanted to highlight a few secondary guys, a few guys who maybe will be in play for the third one. And I don't think Derrick Rose will be in play because of he's missed, you know, half the season. But an absolutely incredible number that illustrates just how much Derrick Rose has changed the Knicks and how much that seemingly not significant trade, a trade, by the way, that a lot of Knicks fans were panicked about because of what it might mean for Emmanuel Quickley.
They were split. They were definitely split at the time.
Knicks the fans. Knicks are plus 13 per 100 possessions with Derrick Rose on the floor. That is insane. That is the point differential of a historically great team. I mean, beyond that, you know, that's like the kind of thing you usually see, that kind of number where you look up like Joel Embiid's on-court differential. Their starting five with Rose in place of Payton has become one of the most reliable lineups in the NBA. He's played lights out for them. Again, he's missed half the season, so I don't think he'll finish third in sixth man of the year, but he has been Derrick Rose. That trade changed the Knicks season.
Shockingly so. Think about the last time Derrick Rose was a Knick and how badly that went and how badly it ended, and the 24 hours MIA where he didn't check in. It didn't just end badly. It ended with bad taste in everybody's mouths, I think, the organization, fans, everything. And so that he can be this impactful of a player at this stage, I don't even know how to describe it, Zach. Like the number of different versions of Derrick Rose we've seen in the 9 years since the ACL, and the number of times we have collectively sort of written him off, and not written off as a possibility of having a career, but in terms of impact, in terms of being a difference maker. What was the year? He's with Cleveland. They trade him. He went and ended up with Utah, where they just waved him out.
Utah was like, goodbye.
Didn't even think 2 seconds about keeping him. That's how just disposable he felt at that moment in time. That's a horrible word to use, but like, I don't know how else to describe it. He was like a player that a team would go like, okay, we made this trade and it was for cap purposes or something, and we're just going to waive Derrick Rose. And look what he's doing with the Knicks now.
Changed their team. And Quickley hasn't really, I mean, his role has taken a little bit of a step back, but he's still on track to make an all-rookie team. He's had a really nice season.
For sure.
And Payton is the one whose minutes have sort of dropped off. And it'll be interesting to see when Alec Burks comes back. You know, he had to sit for health and safety protocols. I think he's eligible to play now. He hasn't played yet. I thought, was another under-the-radar candidate for, yes, you know, a six-man of the year ballot spot too.
Absolutely. No, it was funny because as I was going through this, and I literally went at one point over the weekend team by team, and I thought, like, the Knicks had three guys, like I not all of them in equal measure, of course, but at times this season Quickley felt like sixth man of the year type candidacy. Not played enough or scored enough or done enough probably to really merit that on his own team, of course, given Burks and his shooting, given Rose. By the way, I still don't think I've ever seen – I have not seen Alec Burks miss a shot. I'm convinced of that. I'm convinced he has not actually missed one. But Rose –
shooting 41% from three on 5 attempts per game, when you think back to what kind of shot selection and what kind of player he was earlier in his career – is really remarkable. And people forget about Alec Burks. His career changed when Paul Pierce took him out of the air on a fast break, and he suffered a really bad ankle injury that completely changed his athleticism and his body and put his career in peril. You know, he's going to make Mike Luke Walton all-star, so I can spoil some of it. There was some uncertainty about how that ankle would recover and what kind of rehab plan, and they toggled from one to another and nothing seemed to take. It's been wonderful to see him play such a key role for the Knicks this year, and sometimes like a sort of de facto point guard in a couple of lineups.
I don't know if I've seen a team, I'm sure there have been others, that the Knicks have, I feel like, more guys who either were written off or you just thought they'd already plateaued or whatever. Like, look at the number of guys who are having not necessarily career years. Randall's obviously having a career year, but Reggie Bullock, Alec Burks, Derrick Rose, you know, I don't know if that's maybe that some of that is Tibbs and his staff. Maybe that it's some of that is at the players, and maybe it's the timing of when they got them. Maybe it's just that weird, you know, alchemy that sometimes happens with teams. The right guys get together at the right time and the right system and the right moment, and boom, great things happen. But the number of guys that the Knicks have who are having either career years or bounce back years or just unexpected years is really rather remarkable. I don't know exactly, like I say, how you parse out the credit there, credit to all of them, coaches, players and all, but it is remarkable because it's multiple guys who you say, wow, I could not have seen that coming.
Give me another under the radar sixth man of the year, or maybe not even under the radar, just someone you think maybe probably won't make a ballot, but you want to give him a little love.
I don't know. I guess under that category is Chris Boucher. Seems like a person to throw in there. Won't make it in large part because of their record, but a phenomenal year. He's on the list of most improved player candidates. Again, not sure if he'll make that ballot or not, given the number of great candidates on that one too. But Boucher. So I did this. I got sixth man's always like a really it's a weird, frustrating award.
I love sixth man.
Definition wise,
what frustrates you about it?
What do we actually want out of it? Because traditionally, what we did
here, a good basketball player who comes off the bench and helps his team win games.
That seems fair. So I got weird. I went searching and did Nexus things and all kinds of stuff over the weekend. So I found
Nexus.
LexisNexis, the search engine, for news. I found a story from 1985, right after they had established the Sixth Man of the Year Award, because I was curious about its
only
roots.
You would come on this podcast and be like, well, I found this story from 1985 on LexisNexis. I'm 98 years old, and this is what I did on my weekend.
I got curious. I fell down a rabbit hole. What can I tell you? Red Auerbach. Says in 1985 in this AP story that he established the sixth man concept that helped Boston become an NBA dynasty. Quote, in the old days, Auerbach said, every team used to start its best players and then come in with players of lesser ability. I wanted to change the concept of the game so that the finishing lineup became a team's best. But it took a while because this extra starter, this sixth man, has to be a special player, Auerbach said. And I kind of went down that road, Zach, in part because of all the pushback and all the NBA nerddom, poo-pooing every year. People just vote for the guy who scored the most, who had a bench role. Yeah, because that's kind of what the importance of the role has been. Like, have a guy on your bench who can do things that the starters do, like score a lot. Because sometimes if you, as Red Auerbach says, all your best players are in the starting lineup, all of a sudden your bench, not so potent. And so, yes, sometimes it has been low efficiency guys winning this award. But having somebody who can create and score off the bench is kind of important. So people should be a little less snobby, is what I'm saying. I did also just look to say, like, okay, cause I like precedent. I want to see, like, is there a standard historically? And I did find, if you go by like win shares, very rare that anybody has win shares under 5 and makes sixth man of the year. So you're probably on a winning team. You're on a good team, and you contributed quite a bit to that. Good team. Adjusted for the shorter season this year, 4.4 win shares would be the cutoff.
This is really an impressive level of preparation.
I things got weird. What can I tell you? I did way too much stat.
I'm really interested to see what this number crunching and research has spit out.
Six players this season have win shares of at least 4. Montrezl Harrell, Joe Ingles, Chris Boucher, Bobby Portis, Thad Young, and Jalen Brunson.
Either of the Jazz guys, or just moving.
No, I did. Ingles was in that list.
Oh, Ingles was there,
but Clarkson is not. Clarkson
isn't Clarkson the name of the food processor that it's a Clarkman. It's a Clark. Remember when Kramer installs a food processor in his shower and David Putty immediately is like, is that Clarkson? Is it a Clarkman? Anyway, I'm sorry. I really, by the way, I sympathize with Kramer's desire to live his life in a warm shower. That really spoke to me as a human. Just all of humanity. I don't need you. I don't want you. I just want to be in a nice warm shower.
My daughter takes the world's longest showers. She's 15 now. She's been taking the world's longest showers since she was at least 10. And I can't even criticize that much because my showers are stupidly long, not as long as hers.
All right. So give me the names again. Ingles, Boucher, we already talked about. I agree with you. He's been fantastic.
The guys who at least made that cutoff, Montrezl Harrell, Joe Ingles, Chris Boucher, Bobby Portis, Thad Young, Jalen Brunson. Clarkson's actually like 14th in win shares or whatever, is way below the threshold. He's like 3.1. So like he wouldn't qualify based on historical standards using that particular metric, but obviously he's still in the conversation because of all that he has done scoring wise for a team that has been the best in the NBA for most of the season. So that would be, I think that's the list. It's like, is there anybody you can think of that should be at least in the discussion, as we say?
I've got some good ones for you. So I think if Clarkson and Ingles go 1-2 in some order, and this is just me projecting the total ballot finish, I would bet on a Maverick finishing third, and Jalen Brunson would be one candidate. I think Tim Hardaway Jr. has had an under the radar, very good season that he stamped on. I think it was Friday when he put up 42 or Thursday when he put up 42 in Detroit, when Lucas sat in a game that the Mavericks, you know, again, that was an important game. Tim Hardaway is averaging 16 a game, 38% shooting from three on a lot of attempts. I think he's done a really nice job for them. And Brunson has been outstanding all year long, has great chemistry with Luka, is an absolute bulldog. He's shooting like 70% or something ridiculous at the basket, considering how small he is. I think those are both great names. You want a lukewarm Laker take?
Hit me.
Is Montrezl Harrell the best sixth man candidate on the Lakers?
Statistically, I'd say yes.
Okay.
I would say yes. Between him and Kuzma?
Kyle Kuzma has started 29 games. He will end up coming off the bench for more games than that. He is eligible for sixth man of the year by definition. 13 points, six boards, two assists a game, 44% shooting, 36% from three. And I just think a fine, all-around, tough, gritty, smart, high IQ season. And this is one of my gripes with sixth man of the year voting is people see 29 starts and they just disqualify. He's not a real sixth man. And by the way, Ingles is also piling up a fair number of starts because of injuries. This came up most famously with Lamar Odom one season when he had to start a lot of games for the Lakers because of injuries. And also that he's awesome and was an awesome player. And there were some people, well, is that really a true sixth man? Like, you know, the true sixth man is the Lou Williams, Jamal Crawford, comes off the bench all the time, bench spark plug. And my response was always, I don't know. You could argue that part of being an awesome sixth man is being an awesome fill-in starter when your team needs you to start. And so I don't necessarily look at a large number of starts as any kind of disqualifier or any kind of, you know, contradiction to the essence of what a sixth man is supposed to be. Kyle Kuzma, depending, now they've got this Schroeder injury absence, so he may actually start. If they put him in the starting lineup, he won't be eligible. It's that close. If he's eligible, I think he's a perfectly fine candidate.
If he's so, I'm with you. I like, as long as you meet the mathematical definition of came off the bench for more games than you started, I have no problem with it. If it's going to be Kuzma over Harrell, not necessarily for the top
and
slot.
And I'm not saying he deserves it over Harrell. Harrell is a more traditional six man. He's averaging like 14 a game, had a nice season. Yep. His defensive limitations are pretty glaring. And I think Kuzma has just been a better player, I think, than Harrell this season.
So that is a worthy discussion. The one that people are going to think be having more than that, of course, is the one where we started, which is Ingles versus Clarkson. And I think it's fascinating because Jordan Clarkson fits the prototype of, you know, or at least the recent prototype of the sixth man. Guy who handles the ball, shoots a lot, scores a lot, not particularly efficient, and he's taking almost twice as many field goal attempts per game as Joe Ingles is. So here's a question as we mull that particular debate, those two. Is there value to Jordan Clarkson shooting a lot? Like his efficiency and Joe Ingles' efficiency is just off the charts, ridiculously amazing. But Jordan Clarkson is he's taken more shots than any sixth man candidate in the league, I think by far. But is there something to the fact that he can create, that he can put the ball in play? Is there something to Kobe assists, to borrow from Kirk Goldsberry? Like, is there, if we were trying to make the argument for Jordan Clarkson over Ingles, based on not just points per game, he wins the points per game battle because he takes twice as many shots as Joe Ingles, almost twice as many. So is there a counter argument to say, but you know what? There's value to that.
Because oftentimes I would agree with you that there is just easing the burden on everybody else and letting them slide into
including,
the roles.
Including Joe Ingles.
Interestingly, you know, Clarkson plays a lot in this the Jazz don't have like a five-man bench. They generally have a nine-man rotation, and Clarkson plays a lot of his minutes in a lineup that has been generally very good with Conley, Ingles, Gobert, and George Niang. So there are two starters in that lineup and some very good players. And so you could argue, is he actually taking too many shots away from Conley and Ingles? But I think there is value. And yeah, his efficiency is down to 42% overall, 34% for three, but he's a good playmaker when he passes the ball. I think he's been a good decision maker, extra pass guy for their offense. I get why he's sort of fading a little bit. I still think he's going to win. I mean, even Perk tweeted last night, it's a lock. Jordan Clarkson's going to win. Lock it up, lock it away. And Perk, they said, carry on, carry on.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Was Thad Young on your list?
He was.
Win shares? Yeah. He's another guy that's faded. A little bit when he was, as Stacey King called him, Thagic Johnson, early in the season, just dishing like 8 assists a game, every game seemingly. He's faded a little bit, and he's also started some games. I think he's a perfectly good candidate. He's had a wonderful season for them. I think he's probably been, you know, pre-Vucevic trade, I think he was their second best player by a pretty easy margin. By the way, another Bull, just in terms of raw scoring, who will be eligible if he comes off the bench the rest of the season, is Lauri Markkanen, who's averaging 15 points a game. He will be sneakily eligible for sixth man of the year.
Yeah, that one somehow feels like cheating.
I mean, it does, right? I don't know why that one feels a little bit like cheating. Like, let me pull up his numbers here. He's averaging now he's down to 14 a game, 39% from three. He started 25 games and come off the bench for 18. If he comes off the bench for the rest of Chicago's games, he'll be eligible by one game. He'll have started one more game than off the bench. I'm not going to vote for him. I just think it's by scoring numbers and shooting numbers, if he's eligible, you have to at least give him a cursory glance. It's just when you watch the Bulls, Markkanen's numbers almost surprised me, because when I watch the Bulls, aside from a hot shooting game here or there, I don't come away often thinking, well, he really impacted winning.
No.
Tonight in this game.
No. One other thing, though, which makes it a more academic exercise, at least for me, I think sixth man of the year has to come from a winning team. You know, whether it's a contender or not, which is most years it's been somebody, on a contender. At a minimum, I think you got to be on a winning team. And the Bulls, they've just had a horrific season. So I'm going to scratch when I actually have to sit down to do the ballot. I'm not considering Thad Young
I'm going to make you very, very angry with another guy that I just wanted to at least mention, because he's on a bad team, although a team that apparently is unbeatable against the Dallas Mavericks, and he's a rookie. And so people are looking at him for another award. Tyrese Haliburton, sneakily eligible at six, not sneakily. He's eligible at sixth man of the year. He's been very good this season for the Kings. I don't really get, I mean, he has a pretty solid case, to be honest with you. 13 a game, good shooting, decent defender, really good passer. Like, he's starting now in the absence of De'Aaron Fox, but he's eligible.
Love Haliburton. Who doesn't love Tyrese Haliburton at this point? And yes, I had making my I had multiple lists here, and he was on my list of like deep cuts. He's down there.
Let's do some deep cuts. Let's do some really deep cuts.
Well, that's about as deep as I got.
I'll give you some deep cuts. My deep cuts are just, I want to just mention this guy's name on the Low Post podcast because he's having a nice season. That's all. I just want to mention him. I just want to speak his name. Just let the fans know that, yes, we are noticing you, Naz Reid, having a fine season off the bench for the Minnesota Timberwolves. Really good. Yes. I mean that. Good face-up game, good shooter. has made progress on defense. Yes, Furkan Korkmaz, I see you. We see you. Having a very nice season off the bench for the Sixers, has outplayed Shake Milton for the last 30 games. You know what? Dwight Howard, I see the technicals. I see the antics. I also see 7 points and 8 boards on 60% shooting. He'll never have a good on-off split because he's backing up one of the MVP candidates. He's had a very good season. Here's the deepest one. Not a candidate for Sixth Man of the Year. Not a candidate. I just want to make clear. I just want to say this guy's name. Ty Jerome has had a really nice season for the Oklahoma City Thunder. And now we will move on. That's the end of my ridiculous deep cuts. Are there any other names that are less shallower than that you would like to bring up?
I at least like stopped on for a moment, Miles Bridges, and thought about Tyler Hero.
No, Tyler Hero's out. He hasn't played.
I know. No, I know. These were as I was cycling through and making sure that I had exhausted. I didn't miss somebody from some team who had at least moderate statistics to qualify. That was pretty much it. That was, yeah, we've hit all of them.
I'm glad you brought up Miles Bridges, because if there are two candidates that I think deserve serious, serious consideration, and I have not seen their names pop up at all, and serious consideration, like I don't think to win it, but it's nice to see your name on the ballot. Right? You'd like to see your name on the final, like, hey, I finished third. I'm sure their agents would love to see their names on the ballot. Two that deserves consideration in that regard. Miles Bridges is one. 12 a game, and really, so he's probably almost at 20 a game in the last month on borderline 50, 40, 90 shooting. And also extra points for just murdering people on the regular in games with his dunks. And Doug McDermott for the Pacers, 13 a game, 52 overall, 38% from three. Half his shots are coming at the basket. He's turned into one of the great rim attackers in the league as a secondary option. I think he's had a great season. And when you consider how many injuries the Pacers have had, like all across their roster, without McDermott sort of filling a lot of those gaps at a lot of different positions, I think they're even in a worse spot than they were. So those are the two. And you named Portis is another one that I think deserves some love too. But those are the two that I think you have to give just more of a I'm being thorough. Let me look at them. Those guys have had, Bridges and McDermott have had really, really good seasons.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's good to cast a wide net on this award because it's easy to get fixated on, you know, we have been on Clarkson from day one. That's why Perk can declare it over, right? Because that's one where it's felt like he's been there the whole time, and because he has the scoring lead among bench guys. But I think it's a more nuanced race than that. And I think it should be. Yeah, I mean, if Ingles and Clarkson are both on the ballot somewhere, it's a three-man ballot. Who's that third guy? That's where most people will be spending a lot of time.
And then you have teams like the Grizzlies that just have like a bunch of good bench players averaging 10 points a game, right? Like no one is going to vote for De'Anthony Melton or Desmond Bane or Brandon Clark. Like they're not going to, but they're all having nice seasons. It's just hard to make the third spot. It's just hard. But I like this one. Even, you know, then you have guys like Cam Payne is having a great season for Phoenix, just doesn't play enough minutes, doesn't put up enough raw stats. I like looking at these guys because they're night to night, they're overlooked important parts of their teams. And it's a fun race to do. If I had to predict the order of finish, not your ballot,
yeah,
just how the voting breaks out, what would you predict?
I think it's going to go Clarkson, Ingles, maybe Harrell.
I think I would predict Clarkson, Ingles, Brunson, but I think you're probably going to be right that Harrell ends up, he won last year.
Right.
You know, so there's a certain residual.
And he's on the Lakers and people see him on TV a lot and he's still got the numbers, right? Like that feels like where it'll go. I have no idea what my ballot's going to look like. I think we're getting those ballots tomorrow, aren't we?
I don't know.
I think those are coming soon.
But those are, I don't think I missed anyone that really I wanted to highlight. Those are the main ones. Was there anything we didn't get to about playoff races you wanted to get to? East 4-7 is kind of getting interesting. 1-3 in the East remains interesting. Milwaukee, Brooklyn tomorrow is a big game. If the Bucks win that, things get sort of interesting at the 1, 2, and 3 spots. Philly currently is number one now and they have an Angel Food Cake schedule. That's an important race. Anything else you want to get to?
I have no idea how the East is going to shake out, by the way. I have no idea how to assess any of those. I have no idea how to assess the Nets. Nobody does. It's going to be like the weirdest, weirdest co-favorite, pseudo favorite, whatever they are going in. It's going to be the most impossible to assess ever. No, the only other thing is, as we were exchanging texts over the last couple of days, I did note, like, I would like, since you went out of your way to mock and deride me over my suggestion of a deeper MVP ballot. I think you called it wimpy.
Wimpy, the Howard Beck wimpy MVP proposal. Yes, I did.
Is that calling the proposal wimpy or me wimpy or kind of both?
Both.
Yeah, all right. I'll take that. You know,
you want your proposal is you want 100 players on the MVP, 100 slots on the MVP ballot, for all 450 players are on it. What's your proposal again?
And cupcakes for everybody afterward. Yes. I proposed this, as you know, when you and Rachel and I got together for the Drunk with Power podcast last summer, the first time I think I had floated this. Now more than ever, I feel like there is a very strong basis for going 7 deep, 8 deep, maybe 10 deep on the MVP.
You just started a movie trailer. Now more than ever, in these times, more than ever,
in a world where people are debating too many MVP candidates and someone might get
one hero emerge, and it's Howard Beck.
I always wanted to be the hero in that movie trailer. Just once.
Then they would cut to a shot of you searching on LexisNexis. Like, and Red, in 1972, Red Auerbach said this about MVP.
You liked that nugget. Come on. You liked the Red Auerbach quote.
That's fine.
Someone's got to go look up old Red Auerbach quotes.
In retrospect, in the telling of basketball history, the Celtics invented everything. So let Red have it.
So the way I look at MVP is this. Very. So seriously. So one, Major League Baseball has had a 10-man MVP ballot forever, since like 1931. It has not cheapened anything. It has not hurt anybody. There is a precedent for this, albeit in another sport. Actual MVP contenders, right? So Zach, every year you and I will go through this exercise. All of NBA fandom and punditry will go through this exercise. And it's really two, maybe three guys that are really serious MVP candidates, right? We'll talk about 5, 10, 15, and we'll make our lists. But it's really only one or two guys who are actually going head to head for consideration at the top of the ballot. Sometimes three. So this year, it's really Jokic and Embiid, right? And if you want to say Giannis deserves to still be in there, I'll take that. He's probably third on my ballot right now.
He certainly made his case on national television yesterday with 49 points on 21 of 36 shooting, 4 of 8 from three, outdueling Kevin Durant's 42 points. It was maybe the finest scoring performance of his career, just in terms of the jump hooks, the jumpers, all that. He reminded everyone, hey, I know I won twice in a row. Nobody wants to vote for me again, but I'm pretty freaking good.
And by the way, I'm going to block Kevin Durant, who's impossible to block, while I'm at it. So there's three guys two to three guys again, who are plausibly MVP. And then the reason we have a 5-man ballot is because the fourth and fifth guy, you know, my whole thing, right? Like, I have this standard, right? I think it's both individual excellence and team success, right? So I'm not going to, you know, I did not vote for Russell Westbrook the one year because I thought they didn't win enough games. I think it has to come from the top echelon. So the first two or three guys are going to be the guys who check both of those boxes, who had dominant individual seasons and played for teams that were near the top of the standings. And what we do with the fourth and fifth slot, Zach, every year is, well, somebody wasn't quite as couldn't check one of those boxes, or they're a little shy on that. They're not as dominant, or their team wasn't in the top echelon. So like Steph Curry and Dame Lillard and Luka Doncic are all guys who have had incredible individual seasons, done great things for their teams, have absolutely kept their teams afloat, kept their teams in the playoffs or the play-in. And so those three are all going to be really strong candidates at 4 and 5. I don't think any of those three guys can get to 3 or higher. I just don't, because of the way that I view how MVP is
So who's third then? Giannis is third on your ballot?
I think he's third. And I haven't even mentioned Kawhi Leonard, who deserves serious consideration. And as he's missed a lot of games, but no more than Embiid. I believe at last I looked. And then you've got the Suns and the Jazz are both good, but is it about Chris Paul or is it about Booker? If you're going to go pick one of them, is Gobert or Mitchell, if you're going to pick one of them. And then you've got guys like, you know, Jimmy Butler, you know, like, where would the Heat be without Jimmy Butler? And not only that, but like, dude missed a couple weeks with COVID, and ever since he's been back, they've actually been pretty good. And
Jimmy Butler has had the most under the radar, under talked about great season in the NBA this year.
Agreed. And so, of course, he's a good candidate for maybe the fifth slot, right? Again, not top of the ballot, but we have at least two classes of MVP candidates for the ballot. The guys at the top who could actually win, and then the other guys who have just had outstanding seasons, but there's some flaw on the resume for that season. So this isn't about trying to change the outcome at the top. This wouldn't change the outcome at the top. This is about recording for posterity. This is about, we look at on Basketball Reference, we go see how many times did the guy make the MVP ballot at all? How many appearances do they have? How many MVP points overall when we're ranking guys? And somebody will come back with, well, that's what all NBA is for. No, that's not what all NBA is for. Because one, it's a different standard. We factor winning much more into MVP than all NBA. But two, all NBA is still three teams of two guards, two forwards, and a center. So it's not the top 15 players ranked. It's three groups of guys based on position. A deeper MVP ballot would allow us to still go Jokic, Embiid, Giannis, and then figure out some order of Lillard, Doncic, Curry, Chris Paul, maybe Jimmy Butler, maybe. And I think most of those guys, Zach, will end up out of 100 ballots. We will all have a different assortment of 3, 4, 5s, right? That's how this usually goes. There is some diversity of thought, but I do think there tends to be a little bit of groupthink on these things, and people don't want to stray as far down ballot a little bit more. But I think it would open up more opportunity for guys that were absolutely deserving, and so that we don't end at the end of it say, oh my God, not a single person voted for Jimmy Butler after the season he just had. Because that could happen. You just said it. He's had the most under the radar great season in the NBA this year. He might not get a single fifth place vote. He probably will get a couple, but it could happen. I like the idea of a deeper ballot. It won't change the MVP race. It will just simply acknowledge and record for posterity, for history. These were the other guys who had outstanding seasons and deserved to be in the conversation, as we always say now.
Are you happy? You got to make your case.
Yeah.
Get to do your thing. Okay.
Yeah, I got to do my, and now you can call it wimpy again, and Rachel can mock me again, and you know, we'll go back to normal. But I think there's a legitimate discussion. You have nothing to say about this other than
I don't mind it. I just sort of like the thought exercise. I like that it's a harder choice. Like, I have to try to come up with a way to justify why guy A is the fifth spot and guy B gets left out. And to your point, sometimes there is no way to actually justify it. Their cases are so close. You can see whatever you want to see. There's no difference between them. It's all in the eye of the beholder. Do you like a guy that's a little bit better defender? Do you like a guy that's a little better playmaker? Whatever, you know, then you get into minutes and availability, and it just becomes sort of a morass of stuff. So I get it. I just sort of like to get into the morass, I guess, but I don't mind it. I'm surprised they haven't really considered it, to be honest with you.
Well, it would also, because it's the conversation and because we obsess about MVP all year anyway, does it draw in more people, more fan bases, more people to debate it? I mean, like, that's, you know, the NBA is always in favor of things that will get us to all discuss the NBA more, right? So they could have some benefits for that. That's not why I would want to do it.
It also could result in even more offense taken by fan bases. Can you imagine if there was a 10-man MVP ballot this year and neither Mitchell nor Gobert appeared on it, or neither Paul would appear on it. Chris Paul would appear on every a 10-man ballot. But it would be just as bad as when LeBron said, hey, no slander, but we don't want to pick any Jazz guys. All right, Howard Beck of Sports Illustrated. It's always good to see you. Read everything Howard does. Listen to his podcast. Howard, great to see you, buddy.
You too, Zach. Thanks.